From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a big year for books. New novels from Jeffrey Eugenides, Stephen King, and Haruki Murakami. Big, smart narratives on the lives of Catherine the Great, Malcolm X, and America's favorite dog, Rin Tin Tin. The books of 2011 take us from the Amazon to a dystopian future, from a Pacific Shangri-La to the Antarctic ice. We've got a panel of smart readers with us today to take it all in and to share their favorites. This hour, On Point, the best books of 2011. You can join the conversation. What's your top book of the year? What captivated you? What would you recommend? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got a terrific crew of readers with us today with all kinds of top picks here. Pym and the Pale King and Stone Arabian, Train Dreams, Night Circus, and Death in the City of Light. From New York, Laura Miller joins us. She's staff writer and book critic for Salon.com, author of The Magician's Book, A Skeptic's Adventures in Narnia. Laura Miller, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. With us from Los Angeles is David L. Ulan, book critic for the Los Angeles Times, author of The Lost Art of Reading, Why Books Matter in a Distracted Time, and the upcoming Labyrinth. David Ulan, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. And with us from Glen Ellyn, Illinois, is Becky Anderson. She's co-owner of Anderson's Bookshops with stores in Naperville and Downers Grove, Illinois. Anderson's was named this year's Publishers Weekly Bookstore of the Year. Must be great. And Becky happens to be president of the American Booksellers Association. Becky Anderson, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
Listeners, I should say right at the start, you can see all of our guests' lists of the year's best books on our website, onpointradio.org, and we will also gather your suggestions there as we go. We're going to dive in on particular books, but give me a sense first just of trends this year. Laura Miller, big stroke. What do you see? You've got a little dystopian lit out there and a little gender change?
The things that I noticed with the books on my list this year is that the big novel of ideas was State of Wonder by Ann Patchett, which does a kind of it's a revisiting the theme of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Mm-hmm. And the story that was just about a kind of a love triangle was by Jeffrey Eugenides. And usually we think of men writing the novels of ideas and women writing the sort of stories of relationships.
Right. But they've turned it around.
Yeah, this new generation of novelists are much more flexible in that way.
And maybe a little, I don't know how to put this, but some of the big old names on the literary front have just stopped writing or left this mortal coil in recent years.
Yes,
new folks coming up.
Yeah, the kind of big white male Rushmore figures of, Philip Roth is really kind of the only one left standing. And so I think that there's a little bit more air in the room for people, who are younger and who have sort of fresh things to say. So I think that they're kind of hitting their stride now.
David Ulan, we've got big books, but we've literally got big books. I mean, this has been a year when it's not little slim things to tuck in your back pocket.
Right, there are certainly a few of those, but what struck me, interestingly enough, is that in a culture where we, the conversation is all about sort of speed and brevity, the Twitter conversation, as it were, there are these massive books, the Murakami novel, 1Q84, which was 900-plus pages, the Stephen King novel was 850 pages, Peter Nottis, a Hungarian writer, came in with a 1,200-page novel, a lot of big biographies, a lot of just big, substantial books. For a long time, I've been arguing that, one doesn't preclude the other and that we want both things. So in a certain sense, I'm personally gratified to see that this seems to be being borne out a little bit by what's been coming out in the last 6 months.
Proof, maybe, that even now in the Twitter age, we don't just have the attention spans of a flea. Becky, you've been watching.
We have the attention span of a flea and also the attention span of an elephant. I don't know.
We've got range. We've got real range here, folks. Becky, what about thematically or tonally? What are you seeing as big trends this year?
Well, I think not just for adults, but for kids, you know, as was mentioned, the dystopian stuff. I think so many people, kids too, just want to escape to another world, another time. And we're seeing the books that we're hand-selling so much in the store right now, especially during the holidays, people do. They want to escape to another time. They want to escape to another world, another reality. And kids, especially with the dystopian novels, that there's so many out there right now that they're absolutely devouring. But I think that's true of a lot of adult books. And I think we are seeing those books, like you mentioned, in the length where people are taking the time to sit down and enjoy a book because I think they're tired of a lot of those short snippets that we find in media all the time. So I think there's some really wonderful books out this year, and we're having a great season and telling people about them.
Boy, but we must be dealing with some tough times if all that dystopia is pushing itself to the front of the line. Laura, you point out in giving your top 10 that we've got tectonic changes in the book industry, e-books more popular than ever with everything that means. We saw borders just plain go away this year. The industry's got all of its issues, but books themselves, better than ever and hard to choose just 10. You've got 5 fiction, 5 nonfiction. That's pretty high praise, Laura Miller, to say in spite of all that, books better than ever.
I had the hardest time putting my fiction list together because there were just so much good fiction this year that I had this huge string of honorable mentions. But I just want to say that when, you know, people who value book culture and who especially value being able to find out about books that are not necessarily on the bestseller list, if your local independent bookstore is important to you, then buy there this holiday season. Mm. Buy your gift books there. Don't get them online. If you want bookstores to be around and to be a resource because they're a really important factor in helping people find out about books that are maybe a little off the beaten track, then support them with your patronage, please.
And you hear David Yulin amening that, and no doubt Becky Anderson, president of American Booksellers Association, she's all over that.
You said it perfectly.
I didn't want to make Becky have to say that. Yeah.
Laura, take
Amazon and buy at your local independent. You can turn it around on them that way, I think.
All right, everybody's going locavore
so
here. All right, we got that established. Laura, take us in. Just pick up. Let's pick up Ann Patchett. She's on your list of top fiction here, and it is State of Wonder, of course. As you say, picking up kind of on the formula of Joseph Conrad, but this isn't the Congo. It's an Amazon, but it starts somewhere a little snowier, far northern, maybe ends up in the Amazon, starts in Minnesota. Would you read just a little bit of, for the flavor there?
Absolutely. This is from the very beginning of State of Wonder by Ann Patchett. The news of Anders Ekman's death came by way of aerogram, a piece of bright blue airmail paper that served as both the stationery and, when folded over and sealed along the edges, the envelope. Who even knew they still made such things? This single sheet had traveled from Brazil to Minnesota to mark the passing of a man, a breath of tissue so insubstantial that only the stamp seemed to anchor it to this world. Mr. Fox had the letter in his hand when he came to the lab to tell Marina the news. When she saw him there at the door, she smiled at him, and in the light of that smile, he faltered. "What?" she said finally. He opened his mouth and then closed it. When he tried again, all he could say was, "It's snowing."
From Ann Patchett's State of Wonder, and she had me from Aerogram there, sort of the Facebook of my youth, that bright blue breath of tissue that we used to communicate around the world. What was it about this book that puts it at in a good year, you say, near the top of your list, Laura?
Well, I think it just is a really the ideal combination of great characters, great story. It really has something to say about the contact between the developed and the sort of primal world.
You've got an Indian American pharmacologist sent into the Amazon to check on a brilliant wayward doctor.
Yes, and the thing that makes this kind of different is that pharmacological researcher who's the main character, Marina, is Indian American, and the doctor she's kind of trying to wrangle out of this remote village is also a woman, a former mentor of hers, and the thing that she's researching is this tribe that has this ability to be fertile. The women can bear children into their 60s, and so they have these women have a different relationship to sort of nature and sort of village life than the sort of the characters in Conrad do. You know, they're not it's very different. The relationship that we have to that way of life is very different now from what it was in Conrad's time. And this is just a kind of amazingly eye-opening examination of that. And at the same time, it's such a lush and kind of sweaty and buggy evocation of jungles that you feel like you've been there yourself by the time you're done.
The Amazon women, sweaty, buggy, fertility jungle. I mean, you can scarcely lose. Let's see, Becky, top of your list on the fiction side, Night Circus from Eric Morgenstern. Tell us about it.
Well, this is one of those books where when you finish it, you're so sorry it has ended. It's a great book, even for a crossover to upper YA, but it's a fantastical, magical book. And this is a first-time author, Erin Morgenstern. And I think she's done a fabulous job of blending the magic of the circus and people thinking that the world is illusion, but there really is true magic behind it. These are true, incredible musicians who decide that they, over the years, create a contest between two of their best pupils, and both of them choose. It's sort of set in a Victorian type of London. And
is it in a circus? Is this like Water for
there
Elephants?
There is a circus.
Terrain,
that, yes, there is a circus that's created, and the two pupils create this night circus that opens magically around the world in the middle of the night. The circus opens at midnight, and every tent is more magical than another. The acts are fantastical, and people become huge fans and devoted followers of the circus wherever it goes. But the two magicians, a man and a woman, who are the two students, end up falling in love, but they don't realize that they have to fight to the death.
Whoa.
And one has to win.
Oh, okay.
So it's a great romance. It has great fantasy in it, and though anyone who loves any good story, good romance will love The Night Circus.
We've got it all going on. Love, night, fight to the death, circus all around the world. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the best books of 2011, fiction, nonfiction, real, surreal, with Laura Miller of Salon.com, David Yulin of the Los Angeles Times, and Becky Anderson of Anderson's Bookshops in Illinois, Publishers Weekly Bookstore of the Year. She's with us from Glen Ellyn, Illinois today. And I should say again that our guests are panel's favorites today. Each of their top tens are up at our website, onpointradio.org. We've got lots of favorites coming in online here. Inez loved The Cat's Table by Michael Onaji. Daryl loved the Nile Rodgers autobiography, Le Freak, about the a music producer and sort of disco era, you know, big time guy in the band Chic. Dawn says she loved The Art of Fielding by Chad Harback. Gave me hope in an otherwise disillusioning baseball season for Red Sox fans. Pure joy, Dawn says. We'd love to hear yours as well. 800-423-TALK. David Yulin, I see on yours. We've got Murakami on here with his 1Q84, looks like 1984 when you glance it on the shelf. Now, we know this is surreal, but surreal in what direction, David?
Well, it's actually very gently surreal in a certain sense. It takes place in a slightly alternate universe in Tokyo in 1984. And what's really fascinating about this world, well, a couple of things. I mean, it's a long book, as I said earlier, 900-plus pages. What I loved about it was its really immersive quality. It's one of these long books that you sort of sink into, and you know, it's not difficult, it's complex, but you know, for me at least, I found myself reading it at, you know, 7-8 hour stretches at a time. I didn't want to stop reading it. I wanted to stay in the world. And because it's about a sort of alternate reality, I think that quality just enhances the three-dimensionality of the reality that the book takes place in. I really felt myself drawn into this alternate world that was made all the more real by being very recognizable. The alternate sort of aspects of it are very slight but very significant, and you can go for pages and pages or in the lives of the characters weeks and weeks without those things really asserting themselves, but they always have to wrestle with them. And I think he really kind of creates the ground reality in a certain sense so that it's a totally believable and kind of dimensionalized universe, and I just I love that part of it.
She this starts in 1984, where the protagonist climbs out of a taxi cab on that long road from Tokyo out to the airport. Boy, do I know that road well. How many times? Walks down a ramp, and she's off into something entirely different. Can you read just a little bit for us, David?
Yeah, there's a small passage from the middle that actually speaks to this this quality that I was just referring to. This is a character speaking to another character, and what he says is, "What the real world is, that is a very difficult problem. What it is a metaphysical proposition. But this is the real world. There is no doubt about that. The pain one feels in this world is real pain. Deaths caused in this world are real deaths. Blood shed in this world is real blood. This is no imitation world, no imaginary world, no metaphysical world. I guarantee you that."
All right. You know, Japanese novelists can be incredibly obtuse, but you say you get into this and it just held you.
It just held me. And one of the things that I really liked about it, too, is it's a huge sort of sprawling book about the most simple and in many ways traditional, what are one of those seven classic stories, right? It's a Hollywood thing. You know, boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl,
yeah,
in a certain sense. That's really the driving thrust of the narrative. And in some ways, I sort of love the audacity of kind of building this elaborate universe around that most simple and kind of direct of stories. I think he really pulls it off.
Laura Miller, take us to the marriage plot by Jeffrey Eugenides. You describe this one mentioned as a love triangle. It seems at that level sort of so timeless that you wonder how does it make a splash in the year 2011? How does it?
Well, I think the thing you need to remember is that a novel doesn't even have to be new to mm-hmm. really be a powerful experience for people. I mean, this book is sort of harkens back to the classic novels of the 19th century. It's a little bit more sprightly than a George Eliot novel, but and a little bit more thinky than a Jane Austen novel. But it's in that club. It's the story of three college students in the early 80s going through a lot of things that were very typical for college students in the early 80s. And it's two boys and a girl. And the woman chooses the sort of more exciting but kind of enigmatic man, and the other man, it kind of breaks the other man's heart, and he goes off on a spiritual quest to India, and they have a sort of the other two have a kind of a difficult marriage, and it's and they run into this sort of manic depression issue, and it's you just find yourself caught up in it because the writing is so good, and it's the observations are so sharp and so clever, and the characters are really people that are like people that you would know, and it has all of the strengths of that kind of story. It is an old-fashioned book in some ways, but people still love to read those books. And so the idea that you have to, you know, do something radically mm-hmm. different from that to make an impression on a reader is completely false.
Laura Miller says, yes, it's a book about love, and she calls it Radiant, The Marriage Plot by Jeffrey Eugenides. Laura Miller, David Yulin, Becky Anderson, all with us looking at their favorites from 2011. Let's go to our listeners as well. Robbie in Lexington, Kentucky. Thanks for calling, Robbie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. First, I want to say that I buy all my books at Morris Bookshop, which is our independent bookstore here in Lexington, Kentucky. And one book I bought this year, which I haven't bought a book of poetry in a long time, I've been kind of addicted to nonfiction, and Nikki Finney's Head Off and Split is probably one of the most palpable pieces of word on a page I've experienced, in such a way that you loll the words around in your mouth to find the rage she's expressing, the anguish she's expressing, the desire she's expressing. And it's not always such a heavy book. It lifts you up at times that are surprising. It's hopeful in ways that you can't imagine, even as it's stepping right into pain or fear or longing. And it's just an incredibly musical book.
Hey, that's high praise. This is Nikki Finney's Head Off and Split. Robbie, tell us the rage and anguish and desire. Who's she speaking, I don't know, for or to or about? Can you recognize it?
At times she's speaking about, there's one poem called Cattails about a woman who's waiting for another woman to come see her, and you know it's about a love that's unexpressed. And she she stops at the side of the road to pick a bouquet of cattails to bring her, and neither expects it. It's as if love comes after you in such ways that you don't expect that you're ever going to show up at the door and knock, and there you are standing at the door. And she's very much talking about a fear to express her own lesbian status, what the other woman might find in mm-hmm. her when she shows up at that door. It's just, at times she's talking about Rosa Parks, the moment she decides that this bus is where she's, and this seat is where she's going to sit and never get up. It's sometimes she's speaking for a generation, and at times she's directly speaking about her own love and loss and longing.
Robbie, we've got it, and boy, do you speak well for it. Nikki Finney's Head Off and Split, if you're looking for a poetry collection. Here's a little line from one of hers there. The woman with cheerleading legs has been left for dead. She hot paces a roof 4 days, 3 nights. Her leaping fingers, helium arms, rise and fall, pulling at the week-old baby in the bassinet, pointing to the 82-year-old grandmother from Nikki Finney. Josh in Boston. Josh, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about one of my favorite series for the last 10 years, A Song of Ice and Fire by George R. R. Martin. His newest book came out this summer called Dance with Dragons, and I've just always been amazed by his ability to create literally hundreds of rich, detailed, and flawed characters, and his willingness to kill off the reader's favorite character at any moment.
George R. R. Martin, he was on the show with us a few months ago. Game of Thrones, I think, is the HBO show off his books this year. Becky Anderson, what about the Martin craze? It was very hot for a long time. Is it still? Has he still got a big fan club out there?
Oh, it's still huge. And I think with the HBO series, it's created a whole new interest. But, you know, he takes such care. It takes a number of years when he writes each new volume in the series. And he has such devoted fans. But I think the HBO series has created a whole new group of fans. And the books are huge right now.
Laura, give us another here. What have you got? Pym, Matt Johnson's Pym, P-Y-M. Tell us about it, Laura.
This is that rarest thing, a combination of satire and adventure. It's very funny. It's about a self-described blackademic.
Blackademic as in black academic. Okay.
Yeah, that's what he calls himself.
Right.
He's kind of fed up with the whole game.
Okay.
He doesn't get tenure. In fact, he loses his job because he won't sit on the diversity committee. And he's obsessed with this Edgar Allan Poe novel called The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym. And he discovers by some bizarre chance that novel, which is about a very strange journey to Antarctica, might have been based on the truth. And so sort of, on a wing and a prayer, he and his best friend, who's also laid off and who's a bus driver, and some other people, all African-American, mount this expedition to go down to Antarctica, where they find a strange underground city and a sort of a crazy runaway millionaire artist. And it's just a wild story. Very funny.
I love it. Give us a nonfiction one, David Yulin. You've got The Ecstasy of Influence here. Tell us.
Yeah, this is the Jonathan Leatham collection. One of the other interesting things about this year to me is that there have been a number of really interesting sort of collections of occasional writing or popular criticism called...
Christopher Hitchens has been out there, of course, with his
Hitchens,
big one.
Jeff Dyer had a spectacular book that's on my 10 favorite books list.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of republication of Ellen Willis's rock criticism from The New Yorker in the 60s and early 70s. But the Leatham book, The Ecstasy of Influence, really sort of stands out in a lot of ways. It's a direct homage in a way to Norman Mailer's advertisements for myself. Leatham references that throughout the book. It's, you know, intentionally baggy. It's a collection of essays, reported pieces, book reviews, criticism.
About all kinds of things. I mean, sex and cinema, drugs, graffiti, Bob Dylan, cyberculture, 9/11, book touring, Marlon Brando. It's all over the place.
You got it. Philip K. Dick, everything. And what it actually ends up becoming, and I think what Leatham intends for, first of all, it's a book about self-consciousness, which is a subject near and dear to my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a book that really is a kind of portrait of his inner life and of the relationship of influence to creativity and, in fact, identity. What he's doing in this book is basically embracing all of these elements, high culture, mass culture, rock and roll, science fiction, literature, you name it, that have sort of not only influenced him, but in a lot of ways kind of made him who he is. And so the book becomes a kind of critical, intellectual self-portrait that bleeds into an emotional self-portrait. It's kind of spectacular.
Read us just a paragraph if you've got it there, David.
This is a quote from one of the pieces at the very end of the book, where I think he sort of summarizes something about what he's trying to do and what it means. He writes, "We make lists of things we want to remember, and then we lose the lists. My life is a tattered assemblage of abandoned calendars, misplaced agendas, water-damaged address books with names blurred, family trees I've never managed to hold coherently in mind, third cousins unrecalled, name for third uncles unmet, files of paper I've misplaced or never looked into, schoolwork praised by teachers I can't bring to mind."
From Jonathan
Leetham. All of us. I mean, that's a portrait of everybody.
That is all of us. Jonathan Leetham's The Ecstasy of Influence on David Yulin's Top 10 List for 2011. Let's get a call from San Francisco. Diamond Dave, you're on the air, my friend.
Hey, Michael. We are San Francisco on a rainy day, a good day for a good read.
Okay.
And in San Francisco. And the book I'm suggesting is called Moby Duck. It's the name is a parody of Moby Dick. And it's by Donovan Hohn, H-O-H-N. And it's his adventure. It's not a non-fiction. His adventure. He heard of the loss of all these plastic ducks that were being brought from a factory in China and in the ocean, and they're floating everywhere. He decides to follow it and see what happened, and use it as an exploration of oceanography and the environment. And I have a paragraph here, a few that are
okay. Dive quick. We'll see how much we can get, Dave. What have you got?
Okay, well, I got a couple. Well, what if I followed the trail of the toys wherever it led, to that factory in China, across the Pacific, into the Arctic? I wouldn't be able to do it in a single summer. It would require many months. Maybe in an entire year, I might have to take a leave of absence or quit teaching altogether. And that's the thought he had, and he does it. And it's this incredible tapestry of adventures from the Arctic to China on the high seas.
We'll take it, an incredible tapestry of adventures, Moby Duck. Not Dick, Moby Duck from Donovan Hohn. Dave, thanks very much for your call. Becky, Rules of Civility, tell us about it. What is this? Set in 1938, New York City, martinis and enchantment?
Yes, this book is, if you could put a book and put it on film, put it on the screen, this book would be it. I think he has drawn this time in New York history so beautifully. It's the cinematography, the description he describes just of the air, of the atmosphere is just so thick that you really feel like you're delving into this.
Is it sort of jazz club New York?
It is jazz club. It has mm-hmm. If you had a playlist, there would be some great music that would go along with this book. I think you should listen to a lot of it when you read it. But it's about a young woman. She's only 20 years old, and she lives with another young woman in a boarding house, and they're out to see the world. I mean, with $3, they want to see how far it will go. So they go to a bar where, she meets a young guy. His name is Tinker Gray. He's a handsome banker, and he's sort of involved in New York society. And so this is a young woman. She's the daughter of Russian immigrants, but she's very smart. But she knows that she can maneuver the social mores of what's going on in New York City at the time, that she's going to make it. But she has deep intelligence, and she knows that keeping good girls that are friends and keeping women close to her, that she's really going to survive. So it's kind of a story about what's happening in New York at the time and all the social levels that's going on, what's happening in high society, and how a girl who comes from very, you know, humble beginnings sort of makes it.
We've got Rules of Civility by Emmer Towles. Let me get one more call before the break, if I may. Sorry, Becky, but Carol in Lake Placid, New York. Carol, just a half a minute here. What do you love?
Well, hi. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
This book, The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes,
yes,
is an absolutely fantastic little book. It's only 150 pages. I read it. I gave it to my husband, and then I went online. Everything I read about it said you have to read it twice through because you don't understand, or you get these little things in the beginning that really makes sense the second time. Unless you're extremely astute, you want to talk to all your friends and tell them about it, and then they all call you up, and you all try to figure out the book. It's absolutely amazing.
I love it. A big prize winner in the UK, now on bookstore shelves in the U.S., Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes. I'm glad you raised that, Carol. Thanks for calling from Lake Placid. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking about the best books of 2011. Fiction, nonfiction, real, surreal. We've got a great panel with us. Laura Miller from Salon.com, author of The Magician's Book. David Yulin with the Los Angeles Times is here, author of The Lost Art of Reading and the forthcoming Labyrinth. Look for it next year. Becky Anderson is with us from Anderson's Bookshops in Naperville and Downers Grove, Illinois. Bookshops of the Year, Publishers Weekly says. President of the American Booksellers Association, no less. Lots of response online. Kathy says she loved The Leftovers by Tom Parada. Boston fan says, love the Steve Jobs biography. I guess this means the Walter Isaacson one should be required reading for MBA students who can learn from Jobs' failures and successes. Soli says, please tell me you'll compile a list of the titles your callers recommend. Yes, Soli, we will. They will be up at our website. Becky, give us another one here. Turn of Mind, a literary thriller. This is Alice LaPlante. Tell us about it.
Well, I want to read just a quick section from this. And this is about a brilliant woman who's a surgeon, and she's going through the early stages of dementia, Alzheimer's. And this is a section where she's at her support group. At our Alzheimer's support group today, we talk about what we hate. Hate is a powerful emotion, our young leader says. Ask a dementia patient who she loves, and she draws a blank. Ask her who she hates, and the memories come flooding in. Hatred, hate, the word resonates. My stomach contracts, and the bile rises in my throat. I hate. I find my hands clenched into fists. Faces turn to look at me, some men, mostly women, a variety of races, of creeds, a United Nations of the despised, of the despicable. I cannot make out their features exactly, an anonymous mob.
The hate, just, is it? This is someone with dementia feeling
she's
hate?
She's with dementia, but day to day she can't remember who she is, but she, and one day she will. She's very lucid. But it's watching, it's all told from her. She's the narrator. So that's what's so fascinating about this book, is seeing her fall into the depths of dementia. But also what's involved in this whole thing, and there's a murder mystery. Her best friend and sometimes rival has been found dead. And four of her fingers have been amputated because this woman who's going through the dementia was a famous surgeon that worked on hands.
Oh, no.
So the whole thing is a murder mystery that's happening throughout the book. But you're seeing this woman falling into all the depths. And all of us have seen someone, a loved one, or know someone who's been through this or has a loved one.
Don't we wish that if we must fall in dementia, we don't fall into the hatred end of the pool, but you never know.
That's right.
Laura Miller, you've got Mitchell Zukov's Lost in Shangri-La here on your top nonfiction list. Now, this takes us far afield, not all the way to Antarctica, but getting down that direction from here.
Yeah, and back in time a little. This is happened around the end of World War II, and it was about a bunch of American service people whose plane crashed in what is now Papua New Guinea, and it crashed just about inside this valley that people knew about, but with the sort of aeronautical technology of the time, no one had really been there, but they knew that there were these sort of Stone Age villagers living there who had really had no contact with people from the developed world. And so these soldiers went down, and there were only three survivors, two men and one woman who was a WAC. And they had to send these paratroopers in to get them out. And it's the sort of culture clash of their encounter with these tribes people who thought that they were spirits. And the great thing about this book is that Mitchell Zukov went to New Guinea, and he interviewed some of the people who remembered this event, who were just tribespeople at the time. So the Americans had all these ideas about what was going on around them, but of course they couldn't communicate with these people because they didn't know their language.
But he did it, and hacked his way through the jungle, and there he is.
Of course it's different now, but it's just so funny, the contrast. But this is just this true life adventure story. It's just, you can't even believe that it really happened. It's just such a wild tale.
Outrageous, but true, people have said.
Yeah.
Adam in Lindenville, Vermont. What do you love, Adam?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, the book that I really love this year is Damned by Chuck Palahniuk. He wrote Fight Club. And the reason I really like this book is because it kind of combines like Dante's Inferno with The Breakfast Club and Judy Blume. It's a really unique, quirky work of fiction. And I just love that book.
We'll take it. That's quite a hybrid. Damned by Chuck Palahniuk. Thanks, Adam. Jill in Pocosin, Virginia. Jill, thanks for calling. You're on.
I have a very I'm known as the book aunt, and
okay.
I always give books at Christmas time. And one of my nieces now has reached the magic age of 12. She's mature and reads very well.
Mm-hmm.
And when I look at the reviews on the popular lists, I see nothing but books that are very dark and set in Nazi Germany. And I have no problem with her reading these things, but I don't know her well enough. She doesn't live close to be able to choose that for her.
And this is the young adult's book with all the...
lighter.
Right. You've got enough death and disfigurement. Becky, help us out here. Here's the book aunt who wants to buy one, but isn't sure she's ready to buy into passing the dystopic book to the young'un.
She's 12, you said?
Yeah, she's 12. She's pretty mature 12.
Oh, I think any of the Sarah Dessen books are wonderful books. They're more realistic fiction with contemporary love stories. They're fantastic. She writes so well and always have a great storyline in all of those. They're bright and they have just great storylines.
Jill, good luck. There's a suggestion for you. Harry in Pittsburgh. Harry, you're on the air.
Hello. I had a general question. I'm a big fan of Terry Pratchett.
Not Ann Patchett, but Terry Pratchett?
Terry Pratchett.
Okay.
He's very popular in Great Britain, but you just never hear much about him. He has the Discworld series, and I'm just wondering if your panel is familiar with his writings.
Terry Pratchett. Panel, what about it? Do we know Terry Pratchett?
Oh, of course. He's actually quite popular here as well. And he's actually, his true life story is kind of tragic. We were talking about Alzheimer's earlier. He learned that he has early onset Alzheimer's, and he's sort of putting his affairs in order. And this is a huge story in Britain. You know, he's kind of a fascinating guy. He wrote a book with Neil Gaiman called Good Omens that's very popular. He's very funny. And he has quite a following here as well as in the UK.
And he has a new book coming out next year, too.
Oh, good. We'll look for that. David, our time begins to grow short. Work on down through your list for us. What are a couple of three that you recommend here and why?
Well, I really, I know I was talking about long books before, but I'll recommend a short book, which is Dennis Johnson's book, novel, Train Dreams, or novella. It was published in the Paris Review 8 or 9 years ago, and this is a slightly revised version of it.
Okay.
It's exquisite. It's I think Johnson, sort of tapping into what Laura was saying before, is that, you know, that sort of Mount Rushmore generation begins to disappear. Johnson, I think, has long been sort of the stealth genius of American literature.
And he's writing here about a day laborer in the American West, the start of the 20th century, rugged loggers and bridge builders and work.
Yeah, and it's got, you know, in a lot of ways, it's got the classic Johnson elements of sort of, you know, brilliant description. There's a mystical component to the story. There's a lot of interiority. But it's also a kind of gorgeous sort of portrait of just that period, a man living through that period, a kind of simple guy, not particularly articulate about himself, but deep feeling. And the beautiful tension of the book is sort of between Johnson's articulation and the man's kind of taciturnity. It's really exquisite.
Train Dreams from the American West 100 years ago or so by Dennis Johnson. The Tragedy of Arthur from Arthur Phillips is on your list, Laura. Tell us about that.
Oh, this is such a fun book. It's kind of a tribute, although the book is all about Shakespeare, and it's narrated by someone who claims to be Arthur Phillips, but who is actually not like the real Arthur Phillips, or at least not very much. It's supposed to be a previously undiscovered play by Shakespeare called The Tragedy of Arthur, and it's introduced by Arthur Phillips, whose father discovered this play. But the most of the book is the introduction, which is all Arthur Phillips saying, no, this isn't really by Shakespeare. This is a fake. My father was a con man. He ruined my life. He ruined my twin sister's life. And trying to convince people that it's fake, but he can't do it. And no one will believe him. And although it is about Shakespeare, it's really a tribute to Vladimir Nabokov's Pale Fire, you know, which is a poem where most of the actual novel is in the footnotes of this kind of crazy scholar who's footnoting this poem. And it's, you know, it's one of these things that's just sort of about father and son relationships and rivalry and resentment when your parents let you down, and sibling relationships, and also sort of literary envy. You know, he just resents Shakespeare because his father and his sister love Shakespeare so much, and he's a novelist, and he never, you know, they never pay any attention to what he does. he's just a kind of a hilarious but very human guy. And then all of a sudden, when you kind of get to the end and you realize that he's sort of ruined his life trying to prove that this play is phony, it's very touching and moving because you know that he really cares about the truth and that he's sort of ruined his own life to try to...
A play that his rascal father foisted upon the world.
Yeah, it's a great thing of just, you know, kind of hilarious depictions of the sort of writerly ego that suddenly turns to this really heartfelt story of this man just trying to do the best he can.
The tragedy of Arthur there.
Arthur Phillips. Yeah, yeah.
Becky, you've got on your nonfiction list, you've got this Susan Orlean's book, and we love her, but Rin Tin Tin, The Life and Legend. Now, look, I'm a stone-cold dog lover all the way, but I just can't imagine reading a whole big book about a dog. But
I think it's a lot more than just about a dog. I think it's a story of the times. And considering, you know, that Lee Duncan found the first dog,
Alsatian German Shepherd.
Mm-hmm. Right. Found him in the trenches, you know, in World War I. Mm-hmm. And I think it's more of talking about, was it the dog itself or was it the legend that was created, that created all of the series of Rin Tin Tins and all the movies and television show, everything that ended up happening for her. But I think it's more of a story of the times and what people wanted to watch, wanted to hear about, that brought him out of the depths of World War I. And so it's a really interesting story, more about the man mm-hmm. or the men that were involved in developing this legend of this dog than the dog itself.
No disrespect to dogs. Absolutely love them.
Oh, absolutely not.
Rin Tin Tin makes your list. Alfred in Providence, Rhode Island. Thanks for calling, Alfred. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I was calling because I'm a writer, and I'm always on the lookout for anything that I feel kind of breaks the mold or kind of surprises me, because I feel like so many books these days are stratified in these narrow genres, and one of the things that I do to, you know, fight that, I mean, I read a lot of books, or I start a lot of books and wind up not finishing them, but I also go back and reread some of my favorites from the past, and that kind of reminds me what I feel like a good book should be. And one of the books that I just reread recently was Catch-22 mm-hmm. by Joseph Heller. And that's the kind of thing I'm looking for now, because I feel like we live in this time with the Occupy Wall Street things, and there's a lot of protest and a lot of, you know, kind of fear in the air. And we need more good satire to challenge these kinds of thinking. And I just I don't feel like there's that much of it out there. I mean, there's a little bit. I mean, I like an author. There's author Walter Gretschel. He writes these kind of action novels and horror novels that sort of address these things. But there's no big author that's really touching upon some of these things. I do like Murakami, and I just read the new Neal Stephenson, Rimdi. And I feel like, you know, some of these books are interesting, but when you're talking a book that's 1,900 pages or something like that, unless it's really involving.
You're looking for some more specific gravity there, and you're sort of throwing down a gauntlet from the past. We will look at that, and I appreciate that, Alfred. Laura Miller, I mean, Alfred's kind of dancing around it, but the bottom line thing seems to be, you know, he goes back to Catch-22 or other great books from the past, and he's not finding the same sort of heft, or he's not as moved by what's out there now. What do you make of that comparison between the greats of the past and what, let's say, we got in this year's harvest?
Well, I liked the Neal Stephenson book quite a lot as well, and I liked the Murakami book. I guess I just don't really agree. I mean, it depends on what you think are the sort of institutional ideas that need to be challenged. Because I feel like most of the books on that I picked do that in one way or another, and you know. It's hard to say, you know, everybody, maybe he should give some of them a chance.
give the new a chance, and we'll be glad for that. Let's get a call from Allie in Cumberland, Rhode Island. Allie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
My question is for you, actually. I'm wondering what tops your best reads of 2011.
Oh boy, the top of my list. Now you put me on the spot here. I'm supposed to be the neutral arbiter. I mean, you know, Ali, I read so much in this job that it's I see a lot. It's hard. I really like Townie from Andre Debuse. Terrific, terrific book, and I enjoyed that one a lot. Lots of others as well, but I fall down funny rabbit holes. My daughter's been reading a lot of Seamus Heaney lately. His poetry is not out this year, but boy, have I enjoyed that and been way down into that. Let me just throw those couple out there and hope that works a little bit for you. A Widow's Story, David. This is from Joyce Carol Oates coming back to us about, it's truly her own story as a widow.
It's a memoir about her husband's death. It's interesting because as I read, my list is coming out this Sunday, and as I mentioned there, I'm not particularly an Oates fan, but this book really, really moved me because it's a very close and very claustrophobic portrait of the immediate aftermath of a death. I was going to say the immediate aftermath of grief, but actually it's the immediate immersion
yes.
into grief. And what I think is most powerful about the book is that immediacy. It is just a kind of portrait of the present tense reality of dealing with that experience. And I just found it profoundly moving and really sort of rigorously constructed.
We've got also on your list Binocular Vision, new and selected stories from Edith Perlman, The Information Here. James Glick makes your list. On your nonfiction...
Right. Perlman, I think, lives in Greater Boston, actually. That's a great story. She's been writing short fiction for 35, 40 years, has published a couple of university press and small press anthologies. No one really knew who she was. This book came out as the first book from a press published created by a university in North Carolina. It was reviewed on the cover of the New York Times Book Review, but even more to the point, it's just a spectacular collection of a life's work. This is a really seriously excellent fiction writer that everybody should be looking at. These stories are
terrific. Edith Perlman, oh, the time is always too short. I promise we'll put all the tops up at our website, onpointradio.org. One question, you've got Robert Massey's Catherine the Great on your list, Laura. Do you come out of this book with more or less respect, liking Catherine more or less?
Oh, she's a hugely likable person, just a political genius, a passionate and just a merry person. I mean, that she's just...
That's all we got time for, a merry person, Catherine the Great. Laura Miller, David Yulin, Becky Anderson, thank you so much to each of you. 2011, huzzah, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.